From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm producer Megan Mack alongside host Evan Dawson.
How is it going, Megan Mack?
It's going well. It's another great week here on the show.
You know, I actually thought it was a really strong week on the show, and I'm one of those people who is not easily pleased. And I'm kind of like you. I lay in bed at night and think of all the things I could have done better that day. But I'm pretty. I think the show was very strong this week. We had a tremendous amount of audience participation, covered a lot of ground, and we have a lot to share. So why don't we get to it?
Sure. Well, we opened the week with a discussion about the dynamics of sexual harassment in the workplace. It was a conversation prompted by the resignation of Fox News chief Roger Ailes. Numerous women have come forward to say that Ailes had harassed them over the years, including offering promotions or higher pay for sex.
We talked to Beth Cordello, an employment law attorney, and Jack Tuckner, an attorney focusing on women's rights in the workplace, about why victims of sexual harassment choose to stay with their employers. And that question was sparked by the public questions that have surrounded why Gretchen Carlson and Megyn Kelly stayed at Fox News for years, despite allegations that they had been sexually harassed.
Economic, pure and simple. First, second, and third. This is extremely nuanced, and I'm someone who understands that I enjoy male privilege and white privilege and lawyer privilege, so I don't know what it's like other than as an attorney representing almost exclusively women who find themselves in these situations. It's just not so easy to tell your boss, if you're in the position to say, you hit on me, you subjected me to unwelcome advances that I find insulting or disrespectful, so I'm going to quit. I'm going to walk away from my $2.5 million salary. It's challenging, and I think most people want to go along to get along in the culture that they're in, so they do everything they can to bend over backwards to try to work with that, to hope that it will change. I think there are lots of nuances to when push comes to shove and when someone finally says, I've had it. And that's a very individual thing.
Okay. Beth?
Well, there's a couple of things that stand out to me. First, oftentimes the person who's been harassed does have some type of rapport with the harasser. And women I've counseled have said to me, I really like so-and-so. I just wish he would stop hitting on me. If I could just get him to stop hitting on me, I think that this business relationship could be great. So they're trying to reconcile the fact that here's somebody I respect who is making me feel as though I have to engage in a sexual relationship or put up with some sexual banter in order to get along in the workplace that makes me uncomfortable. And they'll try every other way to get around it because, as Jack says, economics. When I counsel women and they're in this situation and they're trying to figure out what to do, to be honest, once you've accused your employer of this type of illegal conduct, it damages the relationship irreparably. So we start looking at, what are your job prospects if you get retaliated against and fired? Can you support your children? And oftentimes they have to decide to put up with it until maybe they can do something else just because it's not feasible to go the legal route.
We should point out that Roger Ailes has denied all of these allegations. Let's turn now to a discussion about atheists in politics. Just kidding. There aren't any atheists in politics. I don't mean to make light of the subject, but the fact is that there are very few politicians who have come out of the so-called atheist closet. And we saw in the leaked DNC emails, the Democratic staffers nationally were suggesting that maybe Bernie Sanders is an atheist, and if so, that could be used against him with voters.
Our panel discussed why atheists still struggle to get elected to public office. And then we got a phone call from the Finger Lakes. The caller identified herself as Susan, but she was using a pseudonym. She explained that she's an elected official and she's an atheist, but she can't come out. It's not the best phone call quality, but it's a powerful moment that we wanted to share, starting with the beginning of her call.
Hi, yes. I am a local elected official, and I do identify as an atheist, although not openly. So it's hard because I feel like I did the right thing. I didn't put my hand on a Bible, and I didn't say, you know, so help me God, because I wanted my, you know, constituents to know that my ideas come from logic and my thinking comes from logic, and they can trust me to make the best decision, not based on, you know, some feeling that I get that I attribute to the deity.
But Susan, Susan, just let me just jump in and ask you, though. You just said that you are an atheist and that you are not public. You don't share that publicly?
I'm not completely out. No, I am using a pseudonym, but I just thought that people need to know that there are already atheist politicians out there who do not feel free to come out with it completely.
What do you think happens to you if you decide to be public about your atheism?
I think it's possible I might still get reelected, but I think if you just sort of keep it under your hat, people assume that you are a Christian and that you believe those things, and it might seem wrong to not come out, but I have a very beloved elderly family member who it would very much crush if that person were to find out somehow.
Susan, stay on the line, please. And again, she's using a pseudonym, but I want to give Annie Laurie Gaylor a chance to respond to this. She's the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and she's also on the line with us. And Annie Laurie's organization is urging more people to sort of come out of the atheist closet. And Susan is saying she really can't do that right now. She doesn't know if she could be reelected, and she doesn't know how it would impact her family. So Annie Laurie,
well,
what would you say?
We understand that completely, and we always say, If it's possible for you to, if you won't lose your job, you won't lose your family, you won't lose your friends, it's helpful. But there are very few open non-theistic politicians today. We used to have one in Congress, Pete Stark, and we have Ernie Chambers, who's a state senator in Nebraska who doesn't like labels but is really not religious. And, you know, that's about it. So I completely sympathize with her, and I think it's just a symptom of the fact that there's an overwhelming prejudice in today's society, which is a very ugly prejudice against non-believers. And Boy Scouts of America, for example, has been lauded for changing its policy to allow gay boys and gay families, and nobody seems to care that it still excludes non-religious boys and says openly that you can't even grow into the right kind of citizen if you don't believe in a God. And this really shows the degree of prejudice against non-believers. And I'm trying to say that we are moral people. There is this automatic assumption that if you don't believe in a God, you can't be a good person.
But what do you want Susan to do?
It's not what you believe that makes you a good person. It's what you do.
What do you think Susan should do, Annie Laurie?
Well, I think that it's great that she's in politics, and I wish her the best, and I think she's doing the right thing. And she has to determine for herself if it's appropriate to tell anybody. And she may very well know that she might lose votes if she comes out. There are a lot of politicians who are not religious, but they are convinced it's the kiss of death to come out of the closet. And we need to change our society so that's not true.
So, Susan, before we let you go then, do you forever foresee yourself coming out of the atheist closet?
I definitely will once my family member has passed on, but that one family member is the one thing tethering me still to being in the closet, you know, at least happen. I think that that's just because I know that it would just wreck her, and she would never stop thinking about it. It might even cause her to become more ill. So I just can't. I won't until then.
Next, we move into a discussion about plagiarism. You might recall that Donald Trump's wife, Melania, addressed the Republican National Convention and was found to have lifted two passages from Michelle Obama's 2008 speech. Our discussion focused on why plagiarism matters, how to identify it, and how teachers are using this case of plagiarism to educate their students.
So we welcomed Kurt Smith, a former White House speechwriter who now teaches English at the U of R, and Evie Fanning, a local high school English teacher. This clip begins, though, with the plagiarism in question, and it's an edit of both Melania Trump and Michelle Obama speaking at the same time to highlight just how clear it was that Melania Trump's speech had borrowed from Michelle Obama.
The values that you work like hard for what you want
hard
in life.
For what you want in life.
That your word is
that
your bond.
Word is your bond. That you do what you say you're going to do.
Keep your promise.
That you treat people.
That you treat people with respect.
With dignity and respect, and
because
we want our
children
and all children in this nation to know that the only limit to the height of your achievements is the reach of your dreams and your willingness to work hard for them.
All right, so I just want to at least set the baseline. I understand your point that this is, first of all, not a native English speaker, someone who hasn't given a lot of speeches and probably doesn't love the limelight, Kurt, but we can still call a spade, and that's plagiarism, right?
Well, let us also establish something that's rather irrefutable, and that is the incredible bigotry of the national press, which I thought probably had reached its summit with Kennedy versus Nixon in 1960, or perhaps, let's say, 1992 with Clinton versus Bush, but determined even to set a new low for media bias. We've already seen an incredible inclination, Trump being disfavored versus the Democratic candidate, and of course, Mrs. Clinton. I think that the rhetoric on behalf of her has just begun. This story...
I didn't ask you about Clinton, though.
Well,
this is plagiarism, right?
You give me a single standard and we'll embellish at greater length. We don't have a single standard in the U.S. of A.
Whew.
And we haven't had one for several decades right now. Is it plagiarism? Yes.
Okay. Abby Fanning, go ahead.
I was just going to say yes.
You're going to answer in much shorter fashion?
Well, yeah. There is a definition of plagiarism. We do have the MLA style guidelines. There is a definition of what plagiarism is, and that is the textbook definition of plagiarism. Usually the plagiarism that we see is not that blatant. This is actually a fairly simple case of plagiarism.
As a teacher, as an English teacher, what are the standards for your students? Because it's not always entire passages. It's not always an entire page. Sometimes there's a sentence or just a piece of a sentence or an expression or a turn of phrase. How do we start setting standards for what you have to sort of give credit?
And in fact, it doesn't even have to be exact words. If you paraphrase somebody else's ideas, somebody else's points, that's still plagiarism. Plagiarism is borrowing words or ideas. Mm-hmm. In this case, we have both. So intent is somewhat important. There's definitely an ethical piece to this because the legal definition is very narrow. I think when somebody speaks, when I speak, even before I get to the subject of what I'm talking about, I am implying two things. One is that I have something to say. And two is that I'd like you to listen to it. And so if I plagiarize, if I'm using other people's words or other people's ideas and presenting them however I wish, I'm nullifying that first implicit claim right away. I don't have anything to say, in fact. So if I'm saying something when I have nothing to say, that's probably plagiarism. And I think it's offensive to your audience as well, because now you're misleading them by suggesting that you'd like them to listen to something that you have to say when, in fact, you don't have anything of your own.
Speaking of writing ethics, let's turn to a discussion about long-form journalism. Gay Talese is one of the leaders of this form, also called New Journalism. He recently published a piece in The New Yorker called The Voyeur's Motel. It's about a motel owner named Gerald Foose who cut holes in the ceilings of more than a dozen of the building's rooms, covered them with screens, then climbed into the attic and used them to watch his guests having sex. He did this for more than a decade, keeping a record of what he saw and heard. He said he was kind of a new Alfred Kinsey. Foose reached out to Talese and asked him to tell his story. Talese went to Colorado and climbed into the attic with Foose and then spied on motel guests. His resulting New Yorker piece stirred all kinds of controversy, from questions of ethics to gaps in fact-checking. We gathered a panel of long-form journalists and journalism professors to talk about these issues. Here are Jack Rosenberry, Mary Stone, and first up, Eric Grody, talking about if they would have covered the story the way Talese did.
No, definitely wouldn't do it exactly the way Talese would do it for any number of reasons. There's just the practical reasons, the legal reasons, the ethical reasons, and just the journalistic craft of it.
Mary, what'd you think?
I would have reported it to the police, but that's me.
Okay.
But if I were Talese, I probably would have done what he did because he's talented enough to... I can't say I would have done what he did, but I can understand why he did what he did. He had the talent, the experience to tell this story.
You know, if I were a writer and this came to me, I would not have touched it with a 10-foot pole. I mean, I just think that there's so much rationalization going on Foose's part as well as Talese's part that the whole thing just gave me the creeps.
The Talese piece also sparked debate about the future of long-form journalism. Here's Mary Stone again.
I think the financial part is the biggest hurdle. There aren't many organizations that can support that kind of talent to produce a beautiful multimedia long-form piece. But even without the multimedia aspect, I mean, just reading Talese's piece in The New Yorker, which, as you mentioned, was several pages long.
Several dozen pages long, yeah.
It was very agreeable to go through. And I think mobile devices are what have enabled long form to continue, because a few years ago I remember being under the impression that long form was over. I mean, it was the idea that there were going to be these short little bursts of information that people were going to go to. And I think, as I've read in the research preparing for this panel discussion, is that being attached to your PC was limiting in a sense in terms of what people were willing to invest in. But having your iPad on a plane or in a car, in a taxi, for example, people are more inclined to read those long pieces, even if it doesn't have the multimedia aspect. But certainly as a society, we need long-form journalism.
Lastly, let's talk a little bit about food. We welcomed Autumn Stoshek. She's one of those people who, well, a lot of people have told me you have to have her on the show. She's amazing. Well, she's a cider maker at Eve's Cidery in Vanette, New York, which is about 20 miles south of Ithaca. And she's also an activist. Her family was among the first to organize against fracking in the Finger Lakes back in 2009.
When we say cider, we don't mean apple juice. It's a fermented beverage like wine. In fact, Autumn says the apples for cider are very different from the apples for eating, just as grapes for wine are not the same as table grapes.
So here's Autumn, an activist, cider maker, and mother. And it was that combination that convinced her to try to do something most people tell you you cannot do in our region, grow organically.
I got into orcharding, you know, through traditional IPM, and I've actually sprayed a lot of chemicals in my life. But when I had my daughter, my first child, I had this experience where we were doing a project in the orchard, you know, during spray season. This was 10 years ago. And I often took her with me, you know, to work. And I couldn't take her with me. I had to find someone to watch her because it was spray season and the orchard had been sprayed. And then I had this realization, actually, after I worked in the orchard all day long with the trees all day long, that I was going to go home and breastfeed her and probably had exposed myself to chemicals while I worked all day long and would be exposing her as well. And that's when I realized that I was either going to find a way to do it without using those chemicals or I was going to not be an orchardist anymore. And there's a, you know, sort of a common story that you can't grow apples organically in the Northeast. There's a lot of fungal pressure.
Because we should say the sprays that you're talking about, at least on the grape growing side, that's to stop rot, mildew, downy and powdery mildew, same kind of thing in apples?
Similar diseases. We have a disease called apple scab, Anturia inequalis, and that's a disease that will defoliate the trees. So, okay. You know, it's not just like, does the apple look nice? It's, you have to figure out some way to manage it and control it. We have fire blight. It's a bacterial disease. It's been pretty devastating to growers this year. Typically, antibiotics are sprayed to control it. It also kills trees. Yeah, so it's pretty challenging and also not a lot of, you know, not a lot of guidance from Cornell. So
let's follow this up with this. I don't want to malign growers who spray.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's very tough, spraying or not.
Absolutely.
And if you spray, it doesn't make you evil. It doesn't make you not care about the world. But there is this notion that you hear, at least in winemaking, that you just can't go fully organic in the Northeast because of disease pressure, because of all of those factors. And you're saying same kind of thing in a lot of agriculture. What have you found?
So this goes back to people again. And, you know, like I said, I actually came to this as an IPM grower. And I also felt antagonized by organic growers and, you know, their sort of self-righteousness or whatever. So I definitely don't want to come across that way. But, you know, I also think that it's important not to be like a, you know, look at your limiting beliefs, I guess, is, you know, sort of my mantra.
Do you ever spray now?
Yes,
okay.
We do.
Okay, because yep. You're not fully organic.
No, being organic doesn't mean that you don't spray.
That's another important
It means
point,
that
yeah.
you, like the literal definition of this is that you only use Organic Materials Research Institute approved products. They can't be synthetic products, so they're naturally occurring things like minerals. Sulfur, for example, would be a common fungicide that is an organic approved fungicide.
You can hear our entire Summer of Food series of conversations on our website. It's tagged. Each one of the podcasts are tagged. You can find the tag sort of at the bottom. And it says Summer of Food, right, Megan Mack? Is that
Summer
right?
of Food. You can also search for that in the search box.
All right, very good. That does it for this edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can listen to Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR FM 88.5 FM. Did I say FM twice? I did. So it's FM, 88.5 FM. And WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM, FM.
FM, right?
Yes.
FM. You can also find us on the WXXI mobile app. From all of us at WXXI and Connections, have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you Monday.